Chapter 16. Juan was so deep into the J-61 rig that its steel blocked his walkie-talkie from sending or receiving. He probably wouldn't have heeded Max's warning anyway. He'd pushed too hard to fail now. The guts of the platform were as confusing as a Cretan maze, with countless passageways that crisscrossed and doubled back on themselves. It didn't help that his little light stabbed just a few feet into the darkness. He'd cracked his head several times on unseen obstructions and had bruises on his shin and, quite possibly, dents in his prosthesis. Cabrillo had a highly developed spatial sense and had known when the Oregon had first arrived and shouldered the ship closer to an even keel. He could also tell that she was now losing the fight to keep the Hercules on the surface. The ship's list was the worst it had ever been, and when the rig had slid across the deck several feet, he knew he was out of time. And yet he didn't falter, and didn't question if he had done enough and should get out. He tore down a flight of open metal stairs, two at a time, cradling his bad arm with his good to lessen the impact. Down this deep, the rig was an industrial forest of massive cross braces, bulkheads, and thick columns. The floor was bare metal, coated in a thin layer of spilled crude that had congealed to the consistency of tar. It was slick and sticky at the same time. "Linda!" he roared, and in the silence that followed his fading echo, he thought he heard something. He called her name again, louder. There. It was muffled and indistinct, but he heard a response. He raced toward the sound of a woman screaming for help. In the far corner of the space was a closed-off room without windows. A wedge had been rammed under the door as an added precaution, though the handle was locked from the outside. "Linda? Is that really you?" "Galahad to the rescue," he said, and dropped onto his butt to hammer at the wedge with his artificial leg. "Thank God," Linda breathed. "You have to get us out of here." "Us," Juan said between blows. "Soleil Quasar has been a prisoner here for weeks." Even as he worked to free them, Cabrillo's mind went into overdrive. There was no logical reason for Roland Quasar to imprison his daughter and then try to kill her. She was here as a hostage, and thus leveraged to get him to do someone else's bidding. Smith? He didn't seem the type. He was a henchman, not a mastermind. Someone else entirely. They'd spent untold hours tearing into Quasar's life. Only there weren't any clues to his goals because they weren't his goals at all. Some other person was off stage, pulling all the strings, and they had no idea who. And if getting the mysterious item out of the jungle temple had been the goal, Quasar was most likely dead, leaving the corporation with nothing. The wedge finally popped free and skittered away. Cabrillo got to his feet and ripped open the door. Linda Ross came at him in a rush, ignoring his slinged arm. She wrapped her arms around him in a hug that for Juan was equal parts pain and joy. Behind Linda was another woman, who in the weak glow of the penlight, and after so many days of deprivation, still managed to be stunningly beautiful. Her raven hair was raked back into a ponytail, exposing large brown eyes.
"Miss Quasar, I'm Juan Cabrillo. I would have recognized you from Linda's description."
Her accent was charming.
"We need to get out of here, like now."
With Cabrillo in the lead, they made their way back up through the labyrinthine oil platform. Juan was on automatic pilot, trusting his memory to find the straightest route out to freedom, while another section of his mind worried over the identity of whoever was behind the enigmatic John Smith. He'd pump Soleil for information later. Maybe she had an inkling of what was happening, but for now, Cabrillo looked at the problem with just the facts he knew. He tried the walkie-talkie now that they were closer to the main deck.
"Max, can you hear me?"
After a squelch of static, he thought he heard,
"Da air."
"Max?"
Ow.
"We're almost clear."
As they kept rushing up the final set of stairs, the reception improved.
"Juan, Gomez is standing by on the pad, but you have less than a minute. We can't hold her any longer."
"Max, listen carefully. Put an armed guard on McD Lawless. If he tries to get to a phone or radio, shoot him."
"What? Why?"
Hanley's incredulity made his voice crack.
"I'll explain when I see you. Do it."
The last steps were so slanted, it was like running through a funhouse. And when they finally burst out the door to the catwalk suspended over the sea, all three of them crashed into the railing because they couldn't stop their onward rush. Running along the walkway, with the Oregon's deck 100 feet below them and at a 20-plus degree angle, made them all realize that Max's promised minute was overly optimistic. They had seconds before the rig toppled. Gomez Adams held the 520 over the helipad, one skid touching the deck, the other hovering over a massive gap. He was level. It was the platform that was skewed. The tips of the rotor blades on one side of the chopper thrummed dangerously close to the deck.
"Go, go, go!" Juan shouted.
Below them, the rig screeched once again as gravity pulled it closer to the tipping point. The Hercules' rail was buried in the sea, and a gap began to show under the uphill side of the platform as it started going over. In the op center, Eric Stone redirected the drive tube nozzles and put on a burst of speed, redlining the engines in a desperate bid to get the ship clear of the steel avalanche crashing toward them. Aboard the capsizing heavy lifter, Eddie, Link, and Mike had no choice but to hold on to any solid surface they could find, so they clung to the topside railing with everything they had. Cabrillo unceremoniously shoved both women into the chopper as Adams started lifting clear and leapt in after them as the rig slid the rest of the way off the deck. The stress was too much for the platform's spindly drill tower, and it broke free, twisting steel wrenched apart as though it were a balsa wood model. The rig moaned like amplified whale song. The helicopter's tail boom cleared the helipad with inches to spare, its three passengers staring agog at the destruction they had just escaped. The platform crashed into the ocean scant feet from the fleeing Oregon's jackstaff and created a titanic wave that lifted the ship like a toy in a bathtub and nearly drove her bow into the swells. Eric deftly steered them across the wavefront like a surfer, peeling down the face of one of the big ones off Oahu's north shore. The top-heavy rig turned turtle as soon as all of it was in the water, upending so that the air-filled pontoons were pointed at the sky. It bobbed almost merrily. Unburdened of so much dead weight, the Hercules pendulumed back until she was almost straight, before the inertia of water sloshing in her tanks returned her to a deadly list. The three men holding fast to the rails were thrown violently, but managed to maintain their grip. When they let go, each slid across the deck on his backside, maintaining a safe speed by pressing gloved hands and shoes against the plating. When they came up against the lower rail, all three simply stepped into the ocean and started swimming away. Adams maintained a hover over them to direct the rescue launch racing from the Oregon's amidships boat garage. The RHIB reached them just moments before the Hercules succumbed to the inevitable and rolled ponderously onto her side, her barnacle-scaled bottom exposed to the sun for the first time in her long career. Air trapped in the hull burst out through portholes and vents, spewing and sputtering as though the old ship was fighting her fate. And then Cabrillo remembered that this wasn't the end of the affair, but the very beginning, and all thoughts of humor vanished.
"Gomez, get us back to the ship, ASAP.
McDee Lawless had betrayed them from that very first night in Pakistan, and Cabrillo wanted answers. No sooner were they down and the RHIB back up the ramp in the boat garage than he ordered the Oregon to stand off the platform and rake its waterline with the ship's 20-millimeter Gatling gun. The depth here wasn't optimal. The Hercules's crew must have been rushed, after all. But they were over the continental slope, and with luck, the J-61 would tumble down the undersea cliff and end up in the crushing depths of the abyssal plain. Juan wanted no evidence that this act of sabotage hadn't gone off as planned. The heavy lifter wouldn't last another 10 minutes on the surface, and once they'd peppered the rig's floats with a couple thousand holes, it would join the ship on the bottom. Because he was covered in gooey oil from his search for Linda, Cabrillo went to his cabin first, while the two women were escorted to the infirmary for a checkup. As much as he longed for a shower, he simply stripped out of the clothes he'd been wearing, balling them up for the trash rather than tossing them into a hamper, and threw on a navy blue jumpsuit and clean boots. He was down in medical 7 minutes after Adams got them safely home. Max was there waiting, a look of concern on his bulldog face.
First off, glad you're okay. Second, what the hell is going on?
We're both about to find out, Juan said, and led him through the door. About time I get some answers, Dr. Huxley said with mild irritation. Why is my patient under guard?
How are Soleil and Linda?
They're fine. Soleil is a little wrung out from her ordeal, but up until they moved the oil platform, she was cared for. How about it, Juan?
Quasar was duped the same way we were and by the same person.
McDee?
Nope, but let's go have a chat with him.
Juan could see that the guard had taken the added precaution of securing McDee's wrists to the frame of his hospital bed. Cabrillo dismissed him with a wave and spent several seconds eyeing their newest member turned prisoner. Cabrillo started.
I'm going to tell a story, and I want you to correct me where I get it wrong. If I'm satisfied when we're finished, I'll untie you myself. Deal?
McDee nodded. At some time during your most recent posting to Afghanistan when you worked for Fortran, you befriended a local, probably someone younger than yourself.
His name was Attash.
You told him all about your daughter back home in New Orleans, never considering the kid was part of a terrorist cell and that the information you gave him would be used against you. Shame washed over Lawless's face. When they were ready, the cell sent a team to the United States to kidnap her. Proof of her abduction was somehow provided, and you were told that if you didn't do exactly what they said, she would be killed. You had no choice. They set up a bogus ambush to get you across the border into Pakistan, where you were roughed up a little to make your capture appear legit. On a night they knew we were watching that village, you were paraded around, setting us up to rescue you at the same time we nabbed the little boy Setiawan.
I always figured our escape out of that town was too easy, Cabrillo said. Not the ambush on the road later. That was a separate group that had no idea what was going on. But the people in the village were under orders to let us go with minimum fuss.
Hold on, Max said. I thought you said they opened fire on the bus.
Oh, a couple of Johnny Jihadis shot at us, but they either missed entirely or fired up at the roof so as not to hit anyone. It was a show to convince us that we'd made the greatest escape in history. All hat and no cattle, as the old saying goes. Later, after we escaped the roadblock, we had a predator launch a missile at us. I never even saw it, but McDee here did, and moved faster than an Olympic sprinter. He saved our lives. It was an impressive feat for someone supposedly beaten half to death by the Taliban and stuffed into the trunk of a car for a few days. No way would you have been able to move like that.
Your injuries were mostly faked. Lawless didn't deny it.
I don't get this, Hanley persisted. How did they know when we were going to rescue that kid?
You don't see it yet? Juan asked. That kid didn't need rescuing, because his father had sent him to Pakistan in order to lure us to that village.
I must be dense or something. Why lure us there?
The whole thing was set up so that we would take McDee into the fold. Gunawan Bahar is the mastermind of everything we've been through these past couple of weeks. He wanted to plant a spy on the Oregon, so he hired us to rescue his son from the Taliban, while he also planted a man whose daughter's life he controls in place for us to rescue too. It was a brilliant piece of misdirection. As soon as we were double-crossed by Smith in Myanmar, all suspicion automatically went to Quasar. No one ever considered there was another layer to this onion, and that Quasar was no more in control of his actions than McDee. That last statement wasn't entirely true. Since his time at Insane, Cabrillo had harbored a nagging doubt about something. He did not know what, but he sensed that some piece of information he'd been given was off in some way. It was instinct, but that was a feeling he'd learned to trust over the years, so when he saw Soleil on the rig, he knew what had eluded him for so long. What gave it away, he continued, was the timing of the rig being sunk. Bahar knew from Lawless that we'd escaped Insane Prison and had Linda's location because of the tracker chip. That pushed up his deadline to deep-six the J-61 platform by a few days or weeks. The clincher was when McDee came up to the bridge this morning. He'd been told we were steaming hard, but had no idea the speeds the Oregon is capable of. As soon as he left me, he called his handler, Smith, I assume, because of the way he seemed to get under your skin when we were back in the jungle. He told Smith that we were just hours away rather than days. The Hercules still wasn't over the Palawan Trough, but they were out of time. They immediately opened the seacocks and hit the lifeboats. To not only kill Linda and Soleil, but also to hide the fact that the platform was home to perhaps one of the largest collections of interlinked computers outside a government lab. How'd I do? He directed that last question to McDee. Before Lawless could reply, a searing blast of sound made conversation impossible. It was the buzzsaw clamor of the Gatling, raking the sides of the oil rig's ponderous floats. It went on in staccato bursts for a full minute, so that by the time the weapon was withdrawn back into the ship, and its redoubt cover slid back into position, 3,000 fist-sized holes had been blown through the floats, above and below the water. It would slip beneath the waves within the hour. "How about it?" Juan prompted, when it was clear Mark Murphy had finished the job.
"Nailed it. Everything."
"I get it now," Max exclaimed.
"Quasar was controlled because Bahar had kidnapped his daughter, too. All that crap on her website about going to Burma was bogus. They must have tried to get to that temple themselves, failed, and so he used Quasar to hire us, somehow knowing we'd get the job done."
Cabrillo nodded, and with both Smith and his spy on the team, Bahar had regular updates of our progress.
"It all seems so elaborate. Why bother forcing McDee into this? Why the ruse? Bahar could have simply hired us to go into Myanmar."
"Wouldn't work," Juan said. "No motivation. We would never take on some job to go tomb raiding. He needed the type of mission he knew we wouldn't refuse. He'd already proven our soft spot for wayward kids, with the whole deal to save his son, so he just pulled the same trick again, only this time using Roland Quasar's daughter as bait. Then, once he had whatever was in that bag, he called in his friends and the government to take us out."
"Why not work with the government all along?" Max wondered aloud.
"No idea, but there was some reason. Otherwise, he wouldn't have bothered with us at all. My guess is that bringing in the military was a last-minute deal. McDee, any thoughts?
No, sir. They never gave me any information. Just took it.
So you have no idea what was in that bag we recovered from the body in the river?
None at all. And before you ask, I never even knew the name of the guy above Smith. I knew Smith wasn't calling all the shots, but I didn't know who was behind him.
Another mystery solved, Max said, turning back to Cabrillo, is the bombing at the hotel.
What? It wasn't random?
It's obvious that Bahar considers us such a threat that he felt the need to infiltrate our team, but he also took a shot at blowing us up in Singapore to end that threat early.
Juan considered this for a moment and shook his head. I don't think so. As I said before, why not just have Smith blow our brains out as soon as we entered the room? Hanley's face split into a wicked grin.
Because he would know the rest of the corporation would search the ends of the earth for the shooter. But if we died in a suicide bombing, who would they hunt down?
Cabrillo thought that his old friend might be onto something, but a lingering doubt remained. For the time being, the past was unimportant. For now, we need to concentrate on Bahar. We need to find out what he has planned. It's something he sees us threatening, and it's linked to whatever they pulled from the temple.
That's specific, Max said sardonically.
What about my little girl?
McDee asked, mustering as much dignity as he could.
Now that Smith, or this Baha guy, knows I've been found out, they're going to kill her. They've let me talk to her over a webcam. The guys with her are strapped with explosive belts. They're going to blow up my baby.
Who said anything about Smith and Bahar knowing we've discovered why you're here?
I don't understand.
It's simple, really. You contact Smith like you're supposed to and report that the rig was gone by the time we got to it.
Okay,
Lawless said, drawing out the word as if to draw out more information. And then we rescue your daughter, figure out what these sons of bitches are really up to, and nail them to the nearest outhouse door. After the longest, hottest shower he'd had in a long time, Cabrillo went to find Linda Ross. She'd write up a full report of her ordeal, but he wanted to get the highlights quickly to help establish their next course of action. He went first to her cabin to discover that Soleil was there and just out of the shower herself. She had one towel wrapped around her and tucked under her arms, and another wrapped in a turban, covering her hair.
Again, you'll catch me when I am not at my best, she said with a coy smile.
Story of my life, Juan replied. Good timing with everything but the ladies. Linda didn't show you to one of the guest cabins?
She did, but your selection of feminine toiletries is a little lacking. She was kind enough to let me use hers.
I'll get on the steward, he promised, and then asked with genuine concern, How are you? A shadow passed behind her Gallic eyes, and just as quickly it faded.
I have endured worse.
I read up on some of your accomplishments, Cabrillo said, and I was very impressed. However, there is nothing quite like being held against your will. That lack of freedom and control can get to anyone. Powerlessness is perhaps the worst feeling in the world. She opened her mouth as if to reply, then suddenly plopped herself on Linda's bed and buried her face in her hands. She sobbed quietly at first, but soon it grew until her whole body was shaking. Juan wasn't the type to be put off by a woman crying, at least when she had a reason. Pointless histrionics just irked him, but something like this naked expression of fear was something he understood all too well. He sat on the bed next to her, but kept his hands to himself. If she wanted human contact, it would be up to her to initiate it. His instincts at times like this were spot on. In seconds, Soleil had pressed her face into his shoulder. He put an arm around her and simply waited for her to get it out of her system. Less than a minute later, she straightened and sniffled. Juan plucked a couple of tissues from the box on the nightstand and handed them to her. She dabbed at her eyes and blew her nose.
Pardonnez-moi. That was not very ladylike.
You'll be all right now, he predicted. I can tell you are a strong woman, but you've bottled up your emotions for a long time. I suspect you never showed weakness to your jailers.
No, not once.
But that doesn't mean you don't have any. So they come out in a rush at the end. Nothing to it.
Thank you, she said softly.
Her voice strengthened, and a little smile played at the corners of her mouth.
And thank you for saving my life. Linda has such faith in you that she never doubted our rescue. I was not so sure. But now?
The smile turned into a grin.
Now I think you can do anything.
Just as soon as I get my red cape back from the cleaners. The reference confused her for a moment.
Oh, your comic book Superman.
That's me, but I don't do tights. Juan turned serious. I need to ask you some questions. If it's too difficult, we can do it another time.
No, I will do my best.
Or I can come back when you're dressed.
I have a towel.
It is enough, she said with European pragmatism. Did you overhear anything during your captivity? Anything that would give us a clue what this is all about?
No, nothing. They took me from my home in Zurich. Two men broke into my house and attacked me while I was asleep. While one held me down, the other gave me a shot. It knocked me out. When I came awake again, I was in that cell where you found me. I did not even know that it was an oil platform until Linda told me. You see, they had drugged her too, but she says she woke in a helicopter on its way out to sea.
Juan knew that, like himself, Linda would have remained motionless after coming to, in order to get a sense of her surroundings. It was a trick he'd taught her. Do you have any idea why you were targeted?
I assume it has to do with my father, Soleil replied. He is a wealthy and powerful man.
I met him in Singapore when he hired us to go into Burma to look for you.
It is true that I was planning on going to Bangladesh with a friend of mine on an extreme backpacking trip.
We know. The man behind your abduction went so far as to update your website to make it look like you'd left for that trip. They covered themselves well. Anything specific about your father? Any recent business deals?
We are not so close anymore, she admitted sadly.
Cabrillo knew that pretty soon she'd have to be told that in all likelihood her father was dead. Bahar had what he wanted, so Roland Quasar had become a loose end. They would keep searching, of course, but the odds were long that the Swiss financier had been left alive. Okay, then, Juan said and stood. You get some rest, and we'll talk more later.
There are some people I'd like to call, my father and some friends.
I might as well tell you now. Your father is missing. We've been trying to reach him for several days, but haven't had any luck. Also, I'm afraid that until we have a better handle on the situation, we need to keep up the pretense that you died back on that oil rig.
My father? Missing?
And the last time anyone saw him, he was with the man that most likely kidnapped you in Zurich. Guilt, fear, and anger played across her face in a kaleidoscope of emotions. She sat as still as a statue, a beautiful mannequin, her soul having just been torn out. I am sorry, Juan said softly. He wished she hadn't asked about making calls. She wasn't ready to hear this kind of news, not now. Soleil finally looked up at him, a pleading look in her eyes that he wanted more than anything else to satiate. He'd never seen such naked vulnerability. Now he was in territory where he wasn't all that comfortable, because it brought up feelings of his own loss. He hadn't been told about his wife's death until he'd returned from a mission for the CIA, and she'd been in the ground for weeks. With relief, he saw her firm up, straighten her shoulders, and harden her eyes.
I think I would like to get dressed and walk the deck, if that is okay. I have not seen sunshine or felt fresh air in a long time.
She pointed to a suitcase just outside the bathroom that he recognized as coming from the wardrobe section of the magic shop. Linda and Kevin Nixon had already kitted her out. Of course, Juan quickly agreed. If you need anything, feel free to ask any of the crew. Even though we didn't find you where we expected to, they're all relieved that you're safe.
Thank you for everything.
Cocktails in the dining room at 6. Dinner's casual, but I'll wear my cape for you. She smiled wanly at his attempt at humor, and Cabrillo took his leave. He finally tracked down Linda. She was in the exercise room with Eddie Sung. Both were dressed in the traditional gi of martial arts training and were locked in a fight for dominance on the dojo floor. "Not enough action for one day?" Juan teased. Linda flared.
"That dirtball Smith got the drop on me back in the jungle, and I want Eddie to show me what I did wrong."
Sung had degrees in several styles of fighting and was the corporation's instructor. "It can wait. We need to talk." Linda bowed to Eddie and came across the padded mats and bare feet.
"I'll tell you right off the top that Smith didn't give away much. As soon as he got me to Yangon, he hit me with happy juice."
"And you woke up on the chopper, heading out to the rig."
"How did you know that?" she asked, one eyebrow arching.
"I'm Superman. Actually, I just had a chat with Soleil."
"Chat, eh?"
Juan didn't take the bait. "Was Smith with you in the chopper?"
"Yes, and he had the bag. And he made his only mistake. It was on the floor between him and the pilot, and just before we landed, he opened it. Inside were ruby crystals, big ones. I'd say a foot long or longer, and they'd already been cut and polished. I'd never seen anything like it in my life."
Cabrillo had a hard time believing this was all an elaborate smuggling scheme. There had to be something beyond that. Linda was still talking.
"Once we landed, I continued to play ragdoll. They took me straight to the cell with Soleil, so I don't know if Smith hung around for the final act or not."
"I suspect not. Bahar went through a lot of trouble to get that bag. He'd want the stones as soon as possible. Let me ask you something. I discovered that 2 entire floors of that rig were crammed with computers. I'm talking thousands of interlinked machines. Any ideas?"
"Ask the Brain Trust. Mark and Eric are the computer nerds."
"Aren't we supposed to call them ITs?"
"So I'm not politically correct. Sue me. Seriously, you'd have to ask them. I was shoved into the black hole of Calcutta as soon as I was aboard."
Cabrillo found Mark and Eric in Stoney's cabin. They were playing a video game on a giant flat screen that was actually 4 edgeless panels mounted in a square. Juan understood that some games promoted actual skills, but he saw no redeeming features in the 2 of them racing a cartoon car with what looked like an aardvark behind the wheel through a shopping center.
"I guess you guys haven't heard."
"Heard what?"
"Quasar's daughter was on that rig, too. He was used to get to us, and McDee Lawless was a spy."
"What?" the 2 crowed in unison.
"The real bad guy turns out to be Gunawan Bahar. He was the mastermind behind everything. So your priority is tearing into every part of his life. I want to know who he really is and what he's after. When we first contacted Overholt about Bahar, he said that he wasn't on the CIA's radar scope, so you're going to have to dig deep."
"Hold on a sec," Mark said. "McDee's a spy? For who?"
Cabrillo laid out the whole convoluted story, summing up by saying that he and Max both agreed that Bahar felt the corporation represented a direct threat to whatever he had planned. 2 final pieces," he added as a further aside. "Linda saw a bunch of foot-long polished rubies in the bag we recovered in Myanmar, and I discovered that 2 decks of the oil platform had been converted into a massive server farm. Any thoughts?" The 2 young geniuses glanced at each other for a moment, as if sinking their minds. Mark finally spoke up.
Whatever they weren't rubies. Corundum, the base material for both rubies and sapphires, the difference being the presence of trace minerals that give them color, chromium for ruby, iron or titanium for sapphire, has a hexagonal crystal structure, but it's tabular rather than linear.
Cabrillo kept his face impassive, while inside he was screaming, "Speak English!"
"What he's saying," Stone translated, "is that rubies don't grow lengthwise like emerald or quartz, so it is unlikely that Linda saw foot-long rubies. They were some other type of crystals."
That supported Juan's theory that this wasn't about gem smuggling, but this information got him no closer to the truth.
"What about all the computers?"
Mark said, "Obviously, Bahar needed to crunch some major numbers, but without knowing more about him or his goals, it's impossible to say exactly what or why."
"Then you have your marching orders. I want answers."
"You got it, boss man," Stoney replied.